I'm very happy now to welcome John Davis. He is a professor of creative writing at the Institute of American Indian Arts. He's Poet Laureate of Santa Fe. Congratulations.
Thank you.
And he's the author of several books of poetry, and he and a group of his students from IAIA will be reading at the Unitarian Universalist Church on Sunday, November 18th at 3 in the afternoon. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Oh, thank you. It's good to be here.
It's great to have you. Now, let's talk about your poetry is so rich and so varied in ways that are really quite unusual. One of the themes that seems to come up a lot is music, both writing about people who are themselves musicians, and some of the poems that you sent me recently seem like they're songs mm-hmm. that either could be or have been set to music.
Yeah, they have been, yeah.
Do you write the music as well?
Rudimentary music, 3, 4, 5 chords max.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And then what happens? Are you recording?
I just record them for myself right now.
So why don't you read a poem? There's quite a number of poems about mm-hmm. composers, artists from jazz and popular music.
Right. There's actually a section of the new book that deals with Thelonious Monk, who's one of my favorites. I love the percussive style he has, which is very odd, of course. And I was trying to duplicate that in the language. So there are a few passages here that I hope do that. So. And this will come out as a chapbook with Kew Avenue Press eventually, within the next year or so.
Okay.
So this is called Thelonious Monk Plays Duke Ellington. Calm but wrong. The cruelest, this April, this Paris, what now? Light drizzle, pleasant stroll. Lovely the gray sky and the lean woman who walks ahead then behind the long black coat she breathes into the fur collar of. He is the bass climbing the keyboard. She is the sway, blue note, minor second, the clash of similars. The note between tonic and second, if Monk could make it sound, make it resolve these separate fidelities, these privacies, these solitudes among others, but he can't, and when he finally does begin solitude, the single note runs, the left hand reticent, more like a shadow falling across the keyboard than an actual hand. The woman begins to, she's warning the man to keep his distance. His distance, we say, not hers. Then, in the film, I've imagined she becomes the sophisticated lady, and the man eases alongside her. Blonde now she is, in the sunlight simmering through threadbare clouds. They pause and lean together, because it's the 50s. And because she doesn't yet have a language for her needs, she lets go of whatever slight she felt. He lights a single cigarette. They pass back and forth, taking turns smoking and talking. Mood indigo now, where each measure is a question. Splash of jasmine in a window box. Assembly of tulips along a stone wall. Each measure a question, each flower a wish, each flower a wish, a wash, a window now flashing, now rippling, the promiscuous sun everywhere, everywhere at once.
John Davis, and the poem is called Thelonious Monk Plays Duke Ellington.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting combination because Duke is famous for kind of being mainstream and in the middle of jazz and not on the edge, and Monk was always kind of on the edge. And so when Monk finally did play Ellington, it was this, you know, on one hand this kind of percussive, kind of wild, pushing the boundary style, and then the middle of the comfortable middle of jazz coming together.
That's right.
Yeah, so it kind of fascinated me to put those two styles together in one poem.
And also getting a feel for the time
mm-hmm.
in America when all mm-hmm. that was happening.
Right. Yeah, that just happened there was a woman in the poem, there was an argument, and suddenly I realized we have language for how to talk about this now, but in the 50s we didn't really. So things were left unresolved often.
You recently wrote an essay or a poem, I guess, but it was, what was it called? Pozak? Elevator poetry?
Oh, Pozak, yeah.
It was like Muzak and Prozak put together.
Yeah, right.
It was very funny. And poetry, yeah, exactly. That. P-O-E. Muzak, poetry, and Prozak, elevator poetry. There seems to be, I mean, sometimes you read poems which are about other poems and poets and movements in poetry and things like that, and we on the outside may or may not quite know what you're talking about, but it was kind of funny.
Right. There's a lot of inside humor in that. So
yeah.
I never did. I sent it a couple places, and they probably thought it was too pointed a satire.
Right.
And I think everybody was afraid of it. But
because you dissed John Ashbery?
I do. And if you read the lines, you can see why.
Would you like to read any of that?
I could. Yeah, I'll read a little bit of Pozak, also known as elevator poetry. It's a manifesto that I attribute to Alice Van de Vettering, who does not exist.
Who's just you.
But ought to exist, yes.
Right.
And if needed, she will. Poetry has been afflicted with meaning for too long. Certainly there have been stabs at meaninglessness, but without a sustaining podium, without a venue, these movements have flared and died like matches struck and cupped in the general dark of meaningfulness. But the podium has been awaiting us, brightly lit and stark. The elevators, supermarkets, and telephones on hold have been longing for our words to soothe and cajole just beneath the consciousness and then evaporate like hand disinfectant. The venues have been lonely without us. They are calling out for a muttered voice, a semblance of speech that is not speech, an overheard tonal flow of language that does not chomp down on a story or theme and hold on, but one that drifts, that touches worldly things lightly and moves on, that hints at emotion but does not deliver it, kicking and squirming, that employs the language of ideas but does not insist on a full induction into the detailed argument. It is time American poets answered the call. It is time American poets produced sonic texts, well-voiced, well-sounded, but without the dynamics of plot and theme, poems that can deliver a tone in a one-floor hop from copier to office or a long, smooth ride of 40 floors from Lexus to penthouse. What is required is a stream of image and sound that can accompany a shopper from the cereal aisle to dairy to household products without interfering with her thoughts. Only one American poet has come close to producing such poetry, and that is John Ashbery. Ashbery's A Wave is the single monument of Pozak or elevator poetry extant. Younger poets should study this work not for what it accomplishes, but for what it fails to accomplish. Ashbery's avoidance of theme and story is, of course, well established. After flirting briefly with argument in Self-Portrait in a Convex Mirror, Ashbery has pursued a vaguely troubled superficiality that suits the elevator perfectly. His avoidance of conclusion and closure, his natterings and digressions, his use of what I would call the syntax of meaning without any actual meaning, all provide a ground upon which a new generation can build a fully realized Pozak. So.
We're talking to John Davis. Now, you attribute this to a non-existent poetry critic.
Well, she wrote it.
Yeah, she
wrote it. I just found it.
Well, this leads us to another set of questions, which is the various alter egos in which you have written in the past, and all we've right. talked about this with you before, which is that you basically have taken on other personas completely different from John Davis and written poetry in their styles. Are you still doing that?
It still happens to me.
It happens to you.
It happens to me, yeah. I don't seek it out anymore. At first, it was kind of a mixture of will and happenstance, but lately, it just occurs. So when it does, when Alice shows up, I let her write.
You let
her
write
at my computer.
And are there new personas coming in on a regular basis?
In the last couple of years, there've been a couple that I really liked, and I'm kind of hoping that I get to put a little section by each one of them in my book, if my editor goes for it, because I really like the poets. In the past, some of them have been kind of parodic in their nature.
But like this one.
Yeah, it's a parody.
Like and Alice, yeah.
But lately there have been some really interesting poets. Well, in my last book, I took back about 4 or 5 poems from other people.
What are some of the names and personalities of these other people?
I have no idea.
All right, then. Well, I
Chuck Calabrese.
Chuck Calabrese, who has actually appeared on this program and who sounds very different from you. And when you've been in performance with him, he looks very different from you, and people don't even know who's who in the room.
Right, yeah, and that's the fun of it. But yeah, Chuck's supposed to show up on Sunday. We'll see.
Ah, okay.
If there's time, he might show up.
One of the things that I've noticed talking to people who write fiction is that, and this is something they always say, and it seems to be a phenomenon of fiction writing, is that characters show up and they do stuff, and the novelist's job is not to tell them what to do, but to listen to what they're doing and follow it and write it down and all of that. And it has a life of, the process seems to have a life of its own, and you can't contradict what those characters are doing. And I wondered if there was an analogous process for you.
Right, yeah, except they displace me for a while. Would be the only difference. I mean, you always hope, even in your own writing, I think every writing is a kind of or every time I sit down to write, I'm kind of a persona anyway, you know. But when they show up, it's just a little more extreme version of that.
When you say displacement, do you really feel like you're kind of not there?
Yeah, when it's good, I'm not there.
Very interesting. Yeah. And then you come back and read it?
Right, I would get in the way if I were there. Yeah.
This is something that psychiatrists have terminologies for.
I've been told that.
But it's not, I mean, it's just what you do. It's the artistic process.
Yeah, I mean, Dennis Johnson said, this is a sign of deep psychological trouble. But keep doing it.
Now, you are teaching at the Institute of American Indian Arts, and that's its whole own part of your life and all of that. Tell us about the process of teaching the Native people that you teach.
Well, it's a great job, and it's a great group of students. I mean, you know, most of my friends in the world are former students now at this point. So, especially social networking really helped, like, get in touch with people I hadn't been in touch with and stay in touch. And so now when I go to writing conferences, it's my former students that I hang out with. So it's been a great, you know, when I got there, I just felt like I was home. You know, it took a week. Took a week of hazing. But once I got past that week, I felt like this was like where I was meant to be. And I'm not a meant to be kind of person.
Right.
Yeah, and I'm not one who looks for signs, but I just felt really comfortable. And I've remained that way. In fact, I've gotten more comfortable. I feel more at home there than ever.
So getting young people writing is basically kind of a process of leading them to find their own voices and their own ways of doing things, I would think.
Right. Yeah, and one of the things the two early courses I love to teach, Poetry Writing 1, in which I'm really kind of a dictator for a while, and then I loosen up, you know, because the basics of writing poetry are the basics of all good writing. And so I really push the idea that you have to build your work of sensory detail. It's all about images. And I just keep pushing that and pushing that. I write it in 4-foot letters on the board over and over. And then by the end of the semester, I loosen up, which usually creates another round of chaos in which I have to talk about image again. But what I want to do is present them with a lot of possibilities. American poetry, world poetry, is a really diverse body. You can take two poems, and it's hard to tell they're the same species, you know, except they both lay eggs and have feathers. But otherwise you really can't tell that they're the same species. So it's really interesting for me. So I teach contemporary North American poetry, in which I show them everything that's out there, even things that I wouldn't normally read myself, because I want them to see the possibilities and find their voice amidst those. You know, no one finds their voice naively, except for maybe Arthur Rimbaud. but even he didn't. He was studying with Baudelaire.
Right.
you find it late, and you find it through the fabric of other writers, in the fabric of other writers. So, yeah, so reading's important.
We're talking to poet John Davis. Now, let's say you're not dictatorial in that first semester, and you don't keep on pounding into their heads over and over again sensory detail and images. What do they produce?
They produce the kinds of work that I produced for years working on my own. I took a night course in poetry in 1971 when I was 19. And I'd been, well, no, actually 1973 when I was 21. But from when I turned 19 till I was 21, I was writing on my own. It was a disaster. I mean, I was just filling notebooks with my feelings. And when I took that first course, the writer was very good. I think he became an advertising executive, though, instead of a poet. But he never explained, I could not figure out what a poem was for a whole semester. I went and had no idea what I was doing wrong, what I was supposed to be doing, you know, how I might move towards poetry. And that experience has kind of shaped my teaching, because I don't want people to go through a whole semester with knowing nothing about it and just kind of writing every week and turning it in and hoping that it's a poem.
So it was like a here's what not to do experience.
Right. So that was good for me. In the second semester, I figured it out, but I mostly figured it out on my own. I just kept reading and watching the comments from the teacher, listening to the comments from the teacher, gradually figured it out. So after a whole year, last 2 weeks of the second semester, I turned in things that were poems. And he just read them to the class, and he didn't say anything negative about anything in them, so I figured, okay, I finally figured
this
out.
You're on your way.
Yeah.
And so that kind of set your direction.
It did. I mean, I went back to working. I didn't really have money to go to college or even know exactly how one did that. So I kept working for another 5 years. And then one day I found a book in one of those mall bookstores that don't have any poetry except for Suzanne Polish-Schultz and Suzanne Summers. And down the bottom there was a book by a guy named Dick Allen. And I said, wow, these are real poems. Now, what are they doing here? And I turned the book over and it said he taught at the University of Bridgeport, which was about 20 minutes from where I lived. And so I pulled together the poems I'd been writing and I sent him a letter. This was my idea of how you get into college. And he loved them. And he told me to take any course. And then he raved about them in the second workshop. And I went to college.
Amazing.
26-year-old freshman. Which isn't unusual now, but it was kind of unusual then.
Yeah, indeed.
You either went right away or you didn't go. We didn't have all this continuing ed and adult education. And we didn't have a lot of older students.
Well, there are some distinct advantages to going a little bit later because you're hungrier.
Yeah, I was very hungry. I'd hurt my back a couple of times working construction, and I realized I couldn't keep doing that. I didn't have the back for it.
Yeah.
So I knew. And I was, you know, I would go to the library after class and stay till the library closed. And then go home and then get up and go to work because I was still working 32 hours a week. So, yeah, I was devoted.
So, since then, I mean, how has your life gone? You've been writing poetry and teaching pretty much ever since?
Pretty much. I finished at the University. I did 2 years at the University of Bridgeport, packed up my car and drove to Montana, finished my undergraduate there, did my master's there.
Why Montana?
There was a guy named Richard Hugo teaching there, a poet, and there was a fiction writer named William Kittredge, and I liked both of their works, and they were both in the same place, and Montana was inexpensive, the tuition, so I thought, wow, this is a perfect storm here.
Right.
And then after that, I did the usual bouncing around for a while, arts, and I did Provincetown, fine arts workshop, and then I did that for 2 years. And then I finally got a teaching job in Maryland and then drove out to Santa Fe 2 years later. Been at the Institute ever since.
You said a moment ago that first poetry teacher you had didn't tell you what a poem was. Can you tell us what a poem is?
No, but I could tell you how to I could tell you how to get around to writing one. I could get you in the vicinity.
Uh-huh.
And you just get, I mean, it's as simple as starting with image and staying with image and paying attention to the sounds of words and paying attention to every single word. I mean, and when I mean pay attention, I mean really pay attention, you know, some, including looking them up and find, you know, if you don't, at first you don't understand the kind of tastes of words, the fact that they come with histories and they come with like a history of usage, and gradually you get a sense for that. But it takes a while, and I did a lot of dictionary reading and, you know, Oxford English Dictionary reading, and I love etymologies. I have a lot of books of etymologies.
Yeah, every word contains all kinds of metaphors, or
right,
at least one.
Yeah, and they change over time. A lot of times the tone of a word changes over time. So, yeah, so if you do that, you're in the vicinity. And then if the rest is hard to say. You know, who knows what talent is or everything else.
Well, I think, I mean, one of the main things is just drive.
Mm-hmm.
If you just have this, I mean, I know somebody who teaches music who told me the other day, I'd much rather have a student with not so much talent but a tremendous passion than a student with quite a lot of talent and very little passion.
Right. Yeah, you can. There's a lot more successes through the passion than the kind of talent.
So you were reading on Sunday with some of your students from IAIA.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm not sure yet how many. Somewhere between 6 and 8, depends.
And are these people who've been studying with you for quite a while?
Yeah, the ones who are going to who will be reading are all juniors and seniors.
There must be at this point quite a body of Native American poetic tradition and work that has come into being over the last decades.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a great group of young, mainly poets. It's interesting. There's only a handful of fiction writers, but lots of poets. Our own graduates of the Institute have published about, well, since students who graduated since I've been there, since I got there in 1990, have published about 25 books, I guess, of poetry, all with pretty good presses. So there's a great group there. And then there's a lot of younger poets. Natalie Diaz was just in town, just won a Lannan Fellowship. She's a good one.
I think one of the things that's hard and kind of tricky is that we live in a media-saturated culture where poetry is not really part of the mass media at all. And it can kind of fall between the cracks, except in certain kind of subcultures.
Mm. I actually chose it because it fell through the cracks initially. I thought, well, here's an endeavor that's entirely outside the economic world. You're not competing for economic treasure. You know, you're competing if you are competing, and poets are notoriously competitive and notoriously opinionated about other poets. So there is that level of competition, but it's not about money. It's simply about writing well, or sometimes writing a particular way and writing well. So I chose it for that reason. I mean, and that's why we have a poet laureate and we don't have a stockbroker laureate. I mean,
or even a filmmaker laureate.
Yeah, a filmmaker or a fiction laureate, although some states have, they shift fiction and poetry. But fiction writers, generally, if they write novels, get attention. If they write short stories, they might not get as much.
Now, as poet laureate of Santa Fe, what are your duties?
Well, I have to do a couple of education projects, probably one this summer and one next summer. And then I have to do, well, I proposed what I would do. Actually, I don't have to do anything. But what I proposed was to do a couple of education projects. I want to do a project with the History Museum about the history of poetry in Santa Fe. There are some colorful periods of history. And then I'm going to do a series of readings, with other, group readings with other poets, just kind of the poet laureate with, you know, 5 or 6 other poets.
We're talking to poet John Davis. Sometimes you write poems to or about your daughter.
I know. There were so many in the last book, I stopped dedicating them because it started to be for Gracie, for Gracie, for Gracie, for Gracie, and it got ridiculous.
Would you like to read one?
Yeah. Yeah, this is, we lived in Salisbury, Maryland for a while when she was 2 and 3. Salisbury, Maryland, 1989. And it's for Gracie. That was the summer of ferries across the inlets, country fairs, walks among loud birds and flowers. You were living in a world you'd remember almost nothing of, Not the tilt-a-whirl, the hot dogs, the road, dead-ending at the ferry dock, the quick drift across 50 feet of black water, then back on the roads, the narrow, humped roads of the eastern shore. Not the warblers, the wren quick in the cattails, its bright bubbling song. Not the house we poked through on Deal Island, the summer family packing up. Not the ants you said, hello, ants, to every morning. Sometimes suddenly, for no good reason, I want that summer back. Not to do anything different, I'd still lock you in the late morning car and have to rush off to get the keys while the neighbor we hardly knew and never saw again smiled at you from outside. You'd kick again at the timeout door, and when I asked who was knocking, you'd still say, Michael Jackson. And every day would break my heart again, walking with this creature, this daughter, beside me. Small, wispy-haired miracle who took each step up to my office, fearless in pink, or circled and circled my heat-worn body in the one air-conditioned room until it was time to stop and sleep. One afternoon, you flapped and flapped in the backyard, trying to fly with the birds. For 15 minutes, maybe, you ran back and forth, certain it would happen, and why not? It's 20 years later, but nothing's changed, and you've still got me thinking this time. This time, if you start by the magnolia and run flapping towards the board fence, you'll rise up, and when you look down, you'll see me. In Salisbury, Maryland, in 1989, looking up, clapping, running along below you to be there when you finally land.
John Davis is poet laureate. He is professor of creative writing at the Institute of American Indian Arts. He's author of multiple books of poetry and new books coming out sometime next year.
There's going to be a chapbook called Thelonious. I think it's going to be called Thelonious Sphere. His sphere was Thelonious Monk's middle name. That's with QAV Press. And then I have a manuscript about, it's probably another year away from being really finished, that I'll send to Copper Canyon and see what they think.
Well, you, in the meantime, are going to be at the Unitarian Universalist Church on November 18th, which is this Sunday at 3 in the afternoon, reading with a group of students from the Institute of American Indian Arts.
I will. We will.
Well, we look forward to seeing you there, and we look forward to seeing you in the coming year around town as Poet Laureate. It's 2 years, right?
It's 2 years, right.
Yeah. Well, good. Well, thank you so much for being with us on Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
I'm delighted now to welcome back to the program Issa Nyafaga. He is a multimedia artist and activist, and he's up to all sorts of things that we're going to tell you about. For example, tonight at 7:30, he is part of the UN Youth Assembly, organized by Santa Fe Prep, and is giving a talk called The Necessity of Global Citizenship. That's at the Roundhouse tonight. And he will also be teaching a class at Santa Fe Community College upcoming. We'll be talking about that, too. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
So you are always up to the most amazing things. And the latest is that you, as a person from Cameroon, living in the United States and part-time also in Europe, are able to help affect change in your country that you wouldn't be able to do if you were living there.
Yes, that's true. But I also have to say that I did not choose all this fight. They chose me because I find myself in the situation where I am the only person with the resources that I have, the network, the global network that I'm sitting on, who can do that difference, who can make that change in the life of these people.
So one of the things that has happened recently is that there is a major problem in Cameroon, as there is in many countries, where gay people not only do not have rights, but they are imprisoned and persecuted, and Cameroon
right.
is one of those countries.
Yes, I know these cases, but last year, for example, I was going home because I run a summer program for my own organization, which I raise funds here in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and Amnesty International Sweden asked me to try to investigate and find out what's happened to a young man called Jean-Claude Roger Mbede. He was in prison for sending a text message to another man. So the Cameroonian government condemned him for 3.5 years, and he spent 16 months in prison, and he was sick, very, very ill.
For sending a text
message
to a man?
Yes, because the Cameroonian law said that it's against the law to have a sexual activity with two persons from the same sex. Like
right.
Two women and two men cannot
connect.
Make love. Yes.
Right.
So that's what they're standing for. And I do think that is wrong, because I don't think that we're supposed to go to prison for what we do in our privacy. So this is why I chose that mission.
So you found yourself in a situation where you were able to actually intervene and help this guy. What happened?
What happened is that when I arrived in the country, my common sense was to go to the prison where I went to, because I was a political prisoner in Cameroon. So in my city, in Douala, I went to that prison to look for him. And then they say he wasn't there because the gay rights are considered as political issues. So he's probably going to be in the prison in Yaoundé, in Kondengi. So I was also part of an event in the city. So I met the lawyer there, and then the lawyer loved my work, and I told her that I'm looking for one of your clients, which is Jean-Claude Roger Mbede. And then he said he's going to be at the court on Thursday. You come and then you meet him. So and I found out that Jean-Claude Mbede wasn't at the court because they did not sign for his release to go to the court and have and be freed.
He was supposed to be freed, and they just forgot to sign his papers.
He was supposed to leave the prison to go to the court to get
judged,
and he had been doing this trip from the prison to the court like more than 17 times.
Right.
So that day, I had to sign his document, and then they took him to the court. And then his lawyer said that they missioned somebody from the U.S., which is me, to observe the court. So he was free that day. And so I also pay for his transportation from the prison to the court. So I sat with him, and then he told me all his story. Then I took notes, and because I was also a journalist, I said, okay, this deserves an article. So then I wrote the article that I sent out that will be in the website of Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch.
And so this is a great example of how, even though you're from Cameroon,
right,
you were considered an observer from the United States, and that actually helps
right.
this guy's case.
Yes, yes. Because also, you know, in the country, even government officials don't know what's going on around the world, but I do know, and also know how this government act in the country. For example, Cameroonian government has signed a lot of international conventions to be part of the international community, but they are also in conflict with the law that says if you have to go with another man, if you're a man, you go to bed with another man, it's against the law, it's controversial with the international human rights.
So they've signed on to human rights conventions and they're not following themselves?
Not at all. And also in the country, there are only two lawyers, Alice Nkom and Michel Togé, who defend human rights in the country. And lately they've been having threats, like the families have been receiving text messages saying that they will go and kidnap the kids in school and turn them into homosexuals, which is very horrible. And so I've been trying to connect with network of lawyers who are human rights defenders around the world just to support these guys, because I also have my own local fight, which is art and social justice in my village. Where I take doctors and also a social worker, you know, to support the community.
So you are in a situation where in Cameroon, I mean, are there a lot of people imprisoned for being gay?
Yes, there is. There are over 100 people in prison. And then the Cameroonian government still sending people in prison for very, very heavy sentences.
And this is something that, as you say, Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, Lawyers' Rights Watch in Canada, all sorts of groups, lawyers' groups from Switzerland, they're all coming to Cameroon to bring light to this issue.
Right.
Is it having an effect?
It does, but the Cameroonian government is very, very stubborn. And as you know that I was torturing myself for 2 weeks, so it's very, very brutal government. That's why we also need public education from a local leader in Cameroon, because I don't want the situation to be like contrary reaction, you know, like they're getting all this support from the West, then they're going to be like, this is a threat for us. So we also need to reach out to community leaders, because there is very traditional local leaders who can speak to the public and then get them to understand what homosexuality is. Because today in Cameroon, they think that when you sleep with another a person from another sex, you're doing black magic, or you're connecting with evil, all sorts of things, you know. So they don't know really what homosexuality is. And then this local leader also needs some public training, you know, to understand what homosexuality is. So that's what I'm standing for.
Right. And so is there a movement? Is there a movement in villages and cities from one place to another of gay people and their supporters? Educated, you know, of education and just letting people know that they're not up to black magic, for example, things like that?
No, yet. Actually, they are very marginal, and then they're hiding themselves to meet, and then they have their own net club, which is not official. And I do think it's not right. And also, we should also know that in the point of view of the West, even marriage from one man and another man is very conservative. Like, Africans don't kiss in public, you know. But I'm not saying that that's what the gay is going to do. But they should not be going to prison for what they do in the privacy. Because right. There's also a law that says you can't get in anybody's privacy like that, you know. So it's open space for just denunciation. And all the cases that have been in Cameroon, all these people are in prison, is just based on denunciation. Nobody have been caught making love with other people, because you know that they don't do that on public, they do that in privacy.
Right.
So, and it's like the snake biting his own tail, and I think we should stand against it. Not only in Cameroon, because I'm not doing this for Cameroon, I also want to inspire other African who are intellectual living in the West to do that for their own community, because most of the time, when Africans leave Africa, they don't want to look back. So I don't feel like America is a very amazing place. Like, I love Santa Fe. It's my city. I am involved in a lot of things, but I also don't want to forget where I came from. I do want Africans to be inspired by this pilot project.
One of the things that you do, we're talking to artist and activist Issa Nyafaga, is, for example, you gather together supplies, you make it possible for people who are sick to get surgeries, you bring medical supplies, generators, books, textbooks, all sorts of things that you get from other people and other countries. People have contributed here in Santa Fe and in France.
Right.
And you
everywhere.
Bring them back to your village.
Yes. I also have to say that, you know, I send a few emails every day. And when I sit down and look at the month that I just finished, I realize that in the long run, I save 3 to 5 lives every day by sending emails. This is what I do. I just reach out to people. And then the only thing I have to do is just organize events around the state here and in France where I have lived before. So people organize events for me in their home to collect money, and then I come and perform. So you know my performance.
Yeah.
I body paint with live music, and then music is based on improvisation. So that's what I do.
Body paint with live music. And the next time you do that, we will get you back on the radio for a moment to let people know more about that, which
sure.
is a wonderful experience. Give us some examples. When you say you save several lives every day through sending emails, what does that look like?
It looks like 2 days ago, I sit online and I enter a word lawyer and human rights defenders, and I fell in several networks, and I collect those addresses and I send them email and say, I was involved with the case of homosexuality in Cameroon, but right now the lawyer are being threatened, and I just wanted to let you know this case is going on in Cameroon. I also have to wait for the U.S. election to pass, because attention of people were kept by Hurricane Sandy
right. And
then the presidential election. So
now, not only were the people themselves threatened with jail and are going to jail, but the lawyers defend them are
yes.
also being death threatened.
Yes. So, and then only 2 lawyers in the country, and also one of them want to move his family in the U.S. right now as we're talking.
He's moving his family just because he doesn't want them to be under.
Yes, but he may also choose to leave here. So there will be only one woman lawyer, which is Alice Kom, defending human rights. So it's a very, very critical situation where, you know, there's not that much lawyer defending right of people, but also one of them moving, just leaving the country to come here. So it's like a very big threat of the human rights values that we sit on. And we can't let this happen. So I sat on my computer and I did the research and I wrote to those lawyers. And then right away, Lawyer Right Watch, Watch Rights in Canada.
Lawyers, you know, Rights Watch
yes,
in Canada, yeah.
Yes, just replied to me right away and said, we're not aware of this. And how did this happen? And put me in touch with this guy. I want to do something. This is how I can save many lives. Don't. I felt like this is a start to save these two guys' family, you know. And then maybe more lawyers will be inspired to just support that fight. So this is how it looks like for me to be chosen by a fight like this and then sit down and save several lives a day.
You are speaking tonight at 7:30 at the Roundhouse. It's part of the United Nations Youth Assembly organized by Santa Fe Prep. Tell us about that whole event.
The event is around this United Nations Youth Assembly from Santa Fe Prep, which is a school that I work with every day. The necessity of global citizenship is based on how I see my own life as a global citizen, because I've lived in different places around the world. I live in Cameroon, I live in France, I live in Geneva, I live in Washington, D.C., New York, and now in Santa Fe.
Yeah.
And I think what really, really makes me a global citizen is because I'm connected to all these people and I know all the neighborhood of all these places where I've lived in. And it also makes me a very progressive mind, because that's, I only meet people who think like me. And I look like an African man, but when I start talking, all my images, the way I look, disappeared, and people are into my soul, and I'm connected with them. And also, this is what I've been doing in Santa Fe, that, you know, I know more than 7 teachers that I work with every year in public schools. So they call me for different things when they have a problem with intolerance in the school, they have a problem with hatred against Jews or Black or Latinos, or then they call me and say, you work and your story, or what you do and how you behave every day, the kids want to be around you and listen to you and do art projects with you so they can open their minds. So this is what I'm going to be talking about tonight. It's just based on simple things like the way that I feel when I woke up every morning.
Now, in the new semester, you're going to be teaching a class at the Santa Fe Community College. It's called Art, Social Justice, and Creative Expression.
Yes.
little tiny topic there.
I think it's basically a drawing and painting class, but that I'm going to turn into a cartooning and also fan object painting. So it means like a 2D, because I like people to be very, very inspired and be critical thinkers, because it's very, very important that we don't see life as the mass media present it to us. We also have to have our own critical observation of the life through art. So this is something I'm going to be teaching as a cartoonist who I've been teaching also in many institutions for like over 10 years. And we have another class called Fan Object. It means that we have to recycle what we have around us to turn into art. And also, I've been doing that for many years. And this is something that I'm so happy that the dean, Michelle Hesbrook of the Santa Fe Community College, gave me an opportunity to do this spring and invite people who can sign up for the class so we can have fun for 16 weeks.
Very nice. So no money needs to be spent on expensive art supplies.
Not at all, because we can also use our brain just to, you know, go shop in the nature and bring things and put them together and inspire us.
Now, it was your political cartooning that landed you in jail in the first place.
Yes. So, there wasn't any classes even in my country where you can take art classes or take cartooning class. So we have to read other papers coming from different part of the world and adapt it in the younger democracy that was started in Cameroon. But unfortunately, we have to go to jail and get tortured and people get disappeared. But I am very, very fortunate that every morning I stand in front of the mirror and look at myself and say, I'm a very, very lucky man. That's why I do every morning. It's like a kind of a ritual, because I think since I walk out of that prison, I have a 17 year of gift, you know. So I enjoy my days like it was the last one.
You are also doing yet another project, which is you're bringing a community radio station to your village of Nditam, Cameroon.
Yes, yes. I'm working on that project with another filmmaker, Santa Fean, called Sophie Romanier. Sophie Romanier has a father who was a journalist and trained a lot of African journalists and give them scholarship here in the U.S. so they can come for training. And then he's retired and he's joining on this project. So we're starting community radio for women to affect, to improve the life of women in the village. So the radio will be installed by empowered by solar panels, and then local journalists will give training to indigenous people who run the radio for their own language. So we're raising funds now to just get this project going, and anybody who can support is welcome.
How many languages are there spoken around you at home?
At home, 260.
Good heavens.
Languages. And then we have also English and French as the official language. So that's what we use to communicate with the rest of the world. And then we also have Pidgin English. And Pidgin English is a very interesting language. It's a very low quality of English mixed with the local language. And you can find Pidgin English in Hong Kong, in Hawaii, in Ghana, in Thailand, in Malaysia. And I think that's how democracy should be. It should be inspired by local culture, not something that we come to establish with the value from another part of the, from another culture. It doesn't work. You know, it has to come also, be inspired by local culture.
Now, tonight, if people want to show up, can anybody just go over there to the roundhouse?
I think so. It's a public space. It's the taxpayer. It's money from the taxpayers.
Right.
So
okay.
There's no way that nobody can access and listen to us. But I like to inspire those children, because they're going to be leading the world tomorrow, and I don't want them to miss what I experienced. And, you know, so this is only reason why I'm doing this.
Well, it's such an important concept, the necessity of global citizenship in our interconnected world, especially environmentally, but in all these other ways that you've been talking about tonight, human rights and so on.
Right. And also because we live in the age of fast communication and technology. And can you imagine, Mary Chalo, that I sit on my keyboard and I talk with somebody in China, and sometimes it's 1 o'clock here, but in China it's like
2 in the morning.
2 in the morning. And then we are just like, we're touching each other, but we are on the keyboard. And then it's very, very necessary. It's a huge necessity to be a global citizen today. It's very, very important.
If people want to find out more or get in touch with you, is there a web page or a Facebook page?
I have a Facebook page on my name, Issa Niafaga.
And I will connect to that on my website.
Yes, and I also have a website where people can see my project, and it's a very, very sustainable project. And this project also is very inclusive, because anybody has a right to come and see what we have been doing with the money. Like yesterday, donation got from France to the village. And those people can also go to my website. It's www.hitip.org and donate there, you know, to support the project. And they're allowed to come during the summer with us. I prepare everyone to come.
Issa Niafaga is a multimedia artist and activist. Thank you so much for being on the air.
My pleasure. Thank you.